The science is clear. HIV prevention can and does save lives. It is estimated that prevention efforts have averted more than 350,000 HIV infections in the United States to date. In addition to the lives saved from HIV, it is estimated that more than $125 billion in medical costs alone have been averted. But the HIV crisis in America is far from over. More than 56,000 Americans become infected each year, one person every 9.5 minutes. That's from an August 2009 report on the status of HIV prevention in the United States from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
To what extent is HIV/AIDS still a problem in the United States? How does Wisconsin's record on HIV/AIDS compare to the rest of the country? How are young people affected by this disease, and what sorts of prevention programs appear to be successful? Joining us for these and other questions is Nara Cox, professor of continuing studies at the University of Wisconsin and director of the HIV Outreach Project.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
We hear so much about AIDS and have now for more than 25 years that it's hard to even sort out from one day to the next whether we're ahead of the game or not in terms of prevention and cure, if that's even an operative word, versus the number of people who are continuing to get the disease. So where do we stand with all that now?
Well, I think it's really a mixed picture. I would say that we still very much can think of HIV and AIDS as a problem facing society. And I look at both perception, what do we think is going on, and what's the reality, what do the numbers tell us? And I would say that for many people, because HIV and AIDS is off the radar, it's not perceived as an issue. And that's part of our public health challenge, is to make sure that we are talking about this and looking at the realistic picture. It's been described as a national tragedy because it's preventable. And we still have many people, far too many people, who are becoming infected on a day-to-day basis. Just mentioned the national figure of 9.5 minutes someone else is diagnosed with or reported with HIV infection. So clearly, we've got lots of work to do.
Well, if we clarify a point here, does infection mean you stay infected to some extent? In other words, this number continues to grow, then it's not as if people are getting cured of HIV.
Right. That's a really important point, that once a person acquires HIV infection, they have HIV infection for the rest of their lives because there, at this point, is no cure, and it looks like it's going to be a long way off before we have a cure. Sometimes we do talk about AIDS as a part of the disease progression process, a later stage of the disease. But once a person is infected with HIV, they are always infected with HIV. And it becomes a little confusing because with treatment, the viral load that a person may have can go down to undetectable levels. But that doesn't mean that there's no HIV in their body. It means that the test we have isn't sensitive enough to identify the HIV that may be hiding out in some of the cells.
And what is the percentage of people who go on from HIV infection to develop full-blown AIDS?
It really varies. It depends on what is the status of their immune system initially. We think that most people will progress to AIDS at some point if they don't have treatment. But thankfully, with treatment that's available, we can really prolong the number of high-quality life years and the actual number of years in which people are living with HIV infection. I won't say unaffected because it's certainly a devastating disease to have, but the quality of life and the length of time you can live with the infection has been extended.
And the numbers then
time.
Inevitably are going up.
They
the
absolutely
people who
are
have
going,
HIV.
Going up. So that means there are more and more people who are living with HIV, which of course also means the possibility of transmission increases just as there are more people with the infection living full lives.
Can you give us some background on what HIV actually is and why it's sort of got our national attention back, several decades ago?
Well, it's an infection. And early on, I would say that we didn't know a lot about how this, in the very early years, we didn't know how it was transmitted. We certainly know that now. We know what are the main bodily fluids, which is a cumbersome term, but we know what are the bodily fluids, meaning semen and blood and breast milk and vaginal fluids in which HIV can be transmitted. So it was an issue that that we weren't sure about early on. We know much more now. Because it's primarily a sexually transmitted disease, we as a country aren't comfortable talking about that. And so I think that kept some of this under wraps. And the populations that are most affected and continue to be most affected are marginalized populations to a large extent. And I'm talking about men who have sex with men or gay men, people of color, populations that have been marginalized or discriminated against and haven't always had the full attention or commitment of the rest of society to support.
Why would they have these marginal populations, if you want to call them that? Why would they have a higher incidence of it? I mean, why gay sex, for example?
Right. Well, part of that is biological in terms of specific ways in which transmission can take place, which is to say that anyone can become infected with HIV, but we know some behaviors, such as anal sex, has a greater probability of transmission occurring. So that's part of the answer, is just biological. But we also know that there are lots of factors that come into play in terms of how people protect themselves, the information that people have access to, the options people have. And so if you don't have good access to services, good access to information, a community of friends and peers that are committed to living, have the options of living fully and living well and hope in the future, a lot of these things can really detract from decisions you make because they're not really decisions. They're actions by default. So I think all of these things come into play. Even the concept of being able to talk about sexuality with sexual partners and within communities, if that's not the case, if you're not able to do that, then you don't have as many options, I think, in terms of actual decisions and information or resources to use to support oneself.
That would be true of syringe sharers, too, then.
Right, although I think that's a really exciting population in which we have been quite successful. We know that injection drug use is a high-risk behavior. The rates can be extremely high in terms of transmission, but we know that with use of clean needles, it's a very effective prevention strategy. And so in communities of injection drug users that know they have access to clean needles, the rates of transmission have gone way down. And Wisconsin, well, there's a federal ban on using federal funds for needle exchange programs, but Wisconsin has really stepped up and said, we know the science is behind needle exchange. We know it's an effective prevention strategy. And so in Wisconsin, there are a number of needle exchange programs.
Really? Is that sort of like a no ask, no tell kind of thing? How does that work?
Well, there are different sources of funding. So we can not use the federal dollars for that, but use privately.
But as far as the actual exchanges go, I mean, if I'm a drug user and I want to get a fresh syringe, I can just go up to a facility and ask for one, no questions asked? How does that work?
Selected facilities, right. And it's not quite so simple as here is a syringe. There's information and health promotion messages that are provided and HIV testing, which is offered. But there are packets then of syringes and cotton and other supplies, condoms, information that's included. So the combination of tools, really, that would be useful for an individual and the people he or she interacts with or might share needles with to reduce transmission within that social network or with that drug-using network. The science is very clear that it's an effective strategy.
If you look at the national statistics on AIDS right now in this country, mm-hmm. can you give us some sense of how many of the people with HIV/AIDS are male versus female and how it sort of corresponds by racial background as well?
Well, we continue to see that by far this is a classic health disparity, gay men and other men who have sex with men continue to be the population that's most disproportionately affected. That's true across the country, and that's true in Wisconsin. Another example of health disparity would be in terms of racial issues, and people of color continue to be most strongly impacted. In terms of actual statistics, that we can say that in Wisconsin, it looks like that among African Americans, there are about 11 times greater or proportionally more infected than whites when we look at the actual statistics.
Men.
Mm-hmm. And that's true among African-American women, too, even greater, 21 times is the statistic I have, that African-American females, the rate is that much higher than among whites. So disparities in terms of ethnicity, disparities in terms of sex continue to be the pattern nationally as well as in Wisconsin.
If you look more globally, I mean, most of the attention with AIDS is focused on Africa. To what extent is what's going on there related to what's going on here?
It's a different pattern. It is a heterosexual transmission in other parts of the world, and certainly there is heterosexual transmission here in the United States, but the dominant pattern here continues to be among men who have sex with men.
But why the difference between what happens in Africa in terms of the incredible rate of infection versus here?
Right. I think it has to do with how early years and how an epidemic just evolves. Because it began in the United States among men who have sex with men, that has become the pattern that's continued. And that doesn't seem to be the case in some other parts of the world, Africa in particular. So it's an evolution of how an epidemic continues.
So what are the numbers these days, the number of people infected? I mean, again, we've got 25, 26 years now worth of people getting AIDS to accumulate.
Right. In the United States, there are over a million people that are estimated to be living with HIV infection. And the estimate also is that about 1 out of 5 people, in fact, is infected with HIV but doesn't know it.
One out of five in the United States?
Right. And what's so scary about that, or sobering, is that these are people then who are not connected to services to maintain their health. And also, these are people much more likely to inadvertently transmit infection to somebody else. So this really goes back to the CDC's promotion of getting people tested and recommending that HIV testing be considered part of routine health care or medical care, and then people who are considered at risk to be tested more frequently annually.
So if you have HIV, does that rule out? I'm assuming you're a conscientious person. Does that rule out having sex?
No, it doesn't. And there are a number of factors that come into play here. We know that with treatment, the viral load of people can be brought way down, which reduces risk of transmission. It doesn't make it impossible, but it certainly reduces the risk. And perhaps even more important is that we know that condoms provide, when used correctly and consistently, provide very good protection. And so people living with HIV infection can live very full lives in terms of being sexually intimate as well as, you know, the other aspects of one's life. But again, it's so important to know one's status, to be tested, and to get hooked up to treatment if you are HIV positive.
Right now, there is no sort of mandated testing at any point, right?
No, there isn't mandated testing. It's always been voluntary, and that's really made sense because the stigma that's associated with HIV, we don't want to push people away. We want to bring people into testing and to care.
So the ways of actually getting HIV, sex, various kinds being more likely than others. But also you're mentioning breast milk, then an infant can get it by nursing.
Right. That's true. And through the birth and delivery process is another way. We know, though, that by getting pregnant women who are HIV positive connected to care and receiving treatment, that risk of transmission to her baby can be reduced substantially down to as low as 1 or 2%. And in Wisconsin, we've had really wonderful work that's been happening with pregnant moms. And so in the last few years, actually, there had been no cases of transmission perinatally. Last year, I understand there was actually 3 cases, but 2 of those babies were born outside of, I believe they were born outside of Wisconsin, and 1 was born in Wisconsin. So again, the message is, if you're pregnant, as another population, to get tested, learn your HIV status. If you're positive, then to be diligent about getting care and staying in care. And that substantially reduces the risk of transmission to a baby through the pregnancy labor delivery process as well as through breastfeeding.
What would be the rules to live by if you were living in close quarters, working with, you know, at home, et cetera, with somebody who had HIV?
That's one of the very important messages that we've learned over the last 25 plus years, is that we know how HIV is transmitted and how it's not transmitted. And it's definitely not transmitted through what's called casual contact. That's the sharing of the shaking of hands, the touching of doorknobs, the drinking from the same cup.
Kissing.
Kissing is fine as long as it's not, then the term is deep kissing. So the kinds of social routines that most of us go through on a regular basis with friends and relatives and family members and folks we live with do not put us at risk for HIV transmission.
At first, it was sort of stigmatizing. I remember with the Ryan White case and some others where classmates would not want to be with someone with AIDS and so on.
Oh, it was awful. And I think in large part because of those kinds of repercussions, there have been policies put in place, protection in terms of the confidentiality issue for people who are living with HIV. And I'd like to say that we've made huge headway in terms of changing not only the stigma, but those myths. But unfortunately, we still hear about them. I teach we call it Foundations for HIV Prevention course to folks that are involved in doing the frontline work, the on-the-ground work with prevention. And they are still hearing some of these myths about transmitting HIV through toilet seats or concern about sharing dishes with somebody else.
As the joke goes, you could do it, but it'd be very uncomfortable.
Right, right. So I think, you know, for those of us that are older, on one hand, we thought we had corrected those myths or the misinformation years ago, and we forget that young people may not have heard the same information that we've been hearing for a long time, or it may not have been relevant to them in ways that might be relevant now. So we really need to keep providing the basic HIV prevention messages for folks for whom it's new or who haven't heard it, or for whatever reason we haven't been effective in getting that message out there.
You mentioned that it's been off the radar screen. Do you think that's because we sort of go through fads where first it's the Ebola virus and now it's the swine flu, and you know, you sort of have a thing of the moment, and we did our AIDS thing, and so it's kind of a fatigue factor? Is that why we sort of don't think about it as much?
I think that may be part of it. We do rally around a big celebrity, a big name. It makes the front page of weekly magazines for a while, and then we do get tired and move on. So it's hard to know exactly what we can attribute it to, but regardless of the reasons, we're still left in the situation in which HIV is not something that many people are thinking about on a day-to-day basis, and we need to figure out ways to make it relevant, not to the degree that people are concerned about everything they do, but I think as a society, as a culture, we certainly can do better in terms of this being a preventable disease.
Well, HIV and AIDS, certainly, I would hesitate to use the word benefit, but in terms of the awareness of the disease, HIV and AIDS have had the benefit of a lot of celebrity cases, again, because of the population it draws from. There's mm-hmm. a high degree of creativity among the gay population, for example. Mm-hmm. And in its, I guess I'd call it middle years, 10, mm-hmm. 15 years into the epidemic, a lot of celebrity cases that really brought AIDS to the forefront of the public consciousness.
Right. And then I guess the question is then, what happens with that? How does that change how we think about this or what we do on a day-to-day basis or policies we put in place or resources we're willing to direct in a certain way? I think there's also, in working with young people, an inadvertent message that comes from some of that. And I still hear about Magic Johnson and people say, well, isn't he cured? And look, he's able, to live a full life. And so we have to frame messages carefully. Yes, if you have access to good resources and lots of great nutrition and probably all the sleep you need and a place where you know where you're going to sleep at night and some routine to your life, a lot of those things can help you live well and long. That's not the picture for many people who are living with HIV. So just because it doesn't seem like a big deal for one celebrity doesn't mean that we should minimize what this would be like for most people.
Let's look at who is most likely to be affected by age mm-hmm. when we return in a moment. This is University of the Year.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include Wisconsin Farmers Union, a member-driven farm organization committed to enhancing the quality of life for family farmers, rural communities, and all people, saluting co-ops and all they do during October Cooperative Month.
The harsh mathematics of this epidemic proves that prevention is essential to expanding treatment. Treatment without prevention is simply unsustainable. Those are the remarks of Bill Gates. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Nara Cox, and we are talking about the status of AIDS. Let's talk about young people. and AIDS? Because this is a disease that's been around for decades now. How does it look in terms of statistics for young people?
This is another area where I think we really need to be paying a lot more attention. We know that in Wisconsin, most people have been between the ages of 25 and 44 when they're diagnosed with HIV infection. But we forget that a person may be living with the infection for many years. And so if we back off, say, 8 to 10 years from 25, that puts us into the teenage or young adult years when a person may, in fact, become infected. CDC, in fact, at a national level, estimates that about one-half of all people with HIV infection in the United States acquired it before they were 25 years old. And we don't really have any reason to believe that that wouldn't be true in Wisconsin as well. The numbers are not huge in Wisconsin in terms of numbers of young people who have been reported with HIV infection, but they are real numbers nonetheless. As of last year, there have been 270 cases of young people between the ages of 15 and 19 reported with HIV infection, and over 1,160 people 20 to 24 years of age. That's about 14% of all the cases. So to me, I think it's important to remember these are real people. They're not just numbers. It's children living in families. And again, it's a preventable disease. So what should we be doing as a society to change the way those numbers look?
And there are some differences of opinion in that, too, for one reason or another. But if a 25-year-old is just then diagnosed with AIDS, what do they have, or even what is anyone else observing them have to go on in terms of symptoms?
Great question. And there may be no symptoms. And that's why many people delay for many years to get tested, because they have no reason to believe they are in fact infected with HIV infection. For some people, you know, there's a period where they may have flu-like symptoms. They may have a rash. They may experience some symptoms, but for many people, they don't attribute that to being HIV. And so it's really a period of years before they become tested and know their HIV status.
And what if they don't get tested and just keep progressing with the disease? What are sort of the telltale signs?
Sure. Without being tested and being linked up or hooked up to treatment, their immune system continues to be depleted. And so they have generally the disease progression process is that there could be a number of years of asymptomatic years, so nothing really to clue them in. And over time, then, they may experience greater weight loss, night sweats, some opportunistic infections, and this is the combination of the immune system being depleted and the viral load in their body increasing. So again, I can't make the point strongly enough that getting tested is important, and if one is positive, being linked up to care. It doesn't mean necessarily starting on medication right away. That's a decision to be made by the healthcare provider and the patient or the client, but that is a conversation that really needs to happen.
What are the politics of prevention?
The politics of prevention. Well, we believe that prevention certainly is a better use of resources than dealing with problems after the fact. And we know that there are community-based prevention strategies and public health strategies that need to be taking place. There needs to be prevention efforts in the schools, and that's where a lot of politics certainly comes into play. And I think we also need to think in terms of communities of folks and communities meaning faith communities and even neighborhoods and families as smaller communities to figure out what's the good match, what's the best match there in terms of prevention strategies that can be promoted.
Back to the young people that we were talking about, the ones that are coming down with it now, how does that compare with in the past? In other words, is it better? You know, sometimes you hear different numbers about teen abstinence, for example, or just in general about STDs, but I'm just wondering in terms of HIV infection, are you more likely as a teen in 2009 to be coming down with HIV than you are, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago?
Well, I'd say that we know that we have some proxy information to look at. We can look at the behaviors of young people. In Wisconsin and across the country, the Youth Risk Behavior Survey is implemented within schools. This is a national survey conducted every 2 years with high school students to try and get a handle on what are the behaviors of young people. It's not just sexual behavior that's looked at. It's a whole lot of different behaviors. But when we do look at sexual behaviors, it looks like about 45% of high school students report having had sexual intercourse.
How do they report that? I mean, how credible is that? When I was in high school, you know, if we were taking a test like that, the guys would all just, oh, yeah, you know, 10 times a week at least.
Right, I mean,
they wouldn't take it that seriously.
And that often comes up. The CDC folks that do the analysis and Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction that's responsible for it in Wisconsin, they feel pretty confident about the data because of the types of questions, multiple questions that are asked that try and provide the most accurate response. But I think there is – certainly among young people, they're saying, oh, no, when I answered that, I wasn't sure that, you know, I was providing the accurate response. So that gives us some data, though, to say that we know that young people are sexually active and that puts them at some risk. The numbers have been declining some, but we're now beginning to see an uptick in terms of numbers of
really?
Young people who are sexually active.
But
we have to see, I mean, it's really trends we need to look at. And so I want to, you know, reserve judgment in terms of what's happening right now. We also can look at STD data as a proxy. And those numbers, and I don't have the actual statistics in front of me, but the numbers are very high in terms of young people. So again, we know that young people are sexually active and putting themselves at risk. And if they have chlamydia or if they have gonorrhea or if they have any other sexually transmitted infection, there's no reason to believe that that isn't also putting them at risk for HIV transmission. So to answer the question about are young people at less risk now, I'd say that they are at risk. And insofar as more and more people are living with HIV infection, that continues to be a significant risk. And I don't think we need to focus exclusively on HIV. It's the other sexually transmitted diseases, too.
Being at risk is one thing, but they're simply not taking precautions? Is that the upshot of this?
Well, young people would say that they used a condom at last intercourse. Many young people would say that. And while on one hand we want to believe that, and it's probably true a lot of young people, increasing numbers are using protection. The fact that there's still sexually transmitted infections taking place means that condoms are not being used 100% of the time.
There's some spontaneity
there that is
not tied into precaution.
There is.
If you try to look at the high rates in the African American community in particular, what do you see as some of the underlying causes for the disproportionate numbers?
I think, as I said earlier, that because this is a disease that takes place among, or transmission takes place among partners and within communities, it's important to be able to talk about it and to be realistic about what the risks are and to figure out ways to minimize those risks. And so if in a community there is so much stigma that one can't be or a community can't be discussing this and figuring out approaches that are going to work, I think that does contribute to the transmission that's taking place. If we try and hide from it, if we try and ignore it, it just provides an environment in which transmission continues. And I think that's part of what we're seeing in African American communities, not exclusively African American communities, but it is very difficult to say, here's a problem and we need to talk about it. We need to recognize that this is something we need to solve or we need to resolve. So, and I think that, you know, we can't – it's very dangerous to point fingers. I think we all need to look within ourselves and say, how are we assuming the responsibility of having conversations and providing information and making sure that the people we are connected to and care about can protect themselves? And that needs to be done within families. That needs to be done within our circle of friends. It needs to be done within whatever the community is. If it's a community of gay and lesbian people, that's a community. If it's African American folks, those conversations need to be happening there. Hispanic or Latino conversations need to be happening there. Faith communities conversations have to be happening there.
Are you seeing a link between homophobia in general and sort of the approaches to this disease, that it's still got the stigma of being, because it's a gay disease, that people don't want to talk about it? Is that what you're saying?
That is part of what I'm saying. I think that in schools we see some of this and that it's challenging for schools to address to talk about homosexuality. And so as a result, the messages that young people hear either ignore the reality that young people may be gay or lesbian. And so the prevention messages aren't resonating with folks who may be young men who may be at particular risk. So it's easy to sort of write it off and say it's not relevant to me. And at the same time, we're not providing kids for whom it's particularly important the information they need to say, yeah, this is something I need to deal with.
I kind of wonder how HIV and AIDS among, let's say, high school students as an expression of risk behavior compares with smoking, driving without seatbelts, driving drunk and all that. I mean, is it all part of a big kind of a risk-taking pattern? Do you have a sense of that? Or is there something specific about AIDS that makes young people not pay attention to the risks?
Right. I think that societally we've probably better embraced or have better come up with approaches or society saying smoking, for example, is not good and we are going to figure out a range of strategies and we're going to talk about it and we're going to reinforce this and consistent messages.
Easier to talk about.
Easier to talk about, less stigma, although I think there's certainly stigma to smoking nowadays. I think, again, with sexuality, we're not as comfortable. We don't provide the specific or detailed information. We don't provide the opportunities for sexuality to be discussed not just in a biological sense in terms of what happens with this body part and another body part, but what is the context? How do we talk about relationships and what a healthy relationship is? And then within that, what's the role of the sexual intimacy part? So if we know that young people, young gay men in particular, are at particularly high risk, where is that conversation taking place? I mean, those are the questions I think that we need to be asking.
I guess part of the catch is that you have to talk to two people if you're talking about a sexually transmitted disease, whereas with smoking or seatbelts or the other things I mentioned, really just one person. So in a sense, you're kind of doubling your difficulty.
Good point. And I think, we've learned in terms of awareness campaigns, they're not always effective in and of themselves, but we also think that they do have a role. They can normalize conversations. And so if we see the anti-smoking messages, and we've seen those for years and years and years now, and we've seen policies in terms of raising the cost of cigarettes, I mean, all of those come into play. For HIV and AIDS, we haven't done quite as well, I think. There have been public information campaigns periodically, but not certainly in the same big, massive way that there could be.
That's true.
I'm not sure that I would recommend that all our resources go in that direction, but I am thinking of what I saw in Europe a number of years ago, where there were trailers in a movie theater that just normalized talking about HIV prevention. And it was done in an upbeat, kind of fun way. But the sense was, if you're sitting in a movie waiting for the movie to begin and you're with a boyfriend, girlfriend, partner, who you may be spending more time with after the movie, that's a prime time to have a conversation or to have it in your...
They don't do that here, do they?
I haven't seen it.
And it would be... That's interesting. You wonder what the... I mean, you can't imagine it'd be an economic hurdle there that would be that hard to, produce and distribute something like that. But you wonder how the politics, say, with the theaters would be for something like that.
Right.
But otherwise, it'd be the perfect spot because, they're out together alone. They're maybe seeing an R-rated movie in the first place and the lights are low and they're high.
Right. And I think that we... Again, I think it is more than the science that's driving this. It's, as a culture, how comfortable are we with these topics? I mean, another example would be condoms. We don't see condom ads a lot on TV. We certainly don't see buses with lots of encouragement to use condoms if you
can't
are sexually
buy them
active.
On the street either, can
nope.
you? Not in this country.
Not in this country.
I was trying to think if there's any other disease besides HIV/AIDS where it does have that sort of, the sense that has come to it that it's, the result of a sin and therefore you deserve what you're getting kind of thing, some of the attitudes that have been there from the beginning. I can't think of any other disease where we sort of do that to it.
I think that's a good point.
And
nothing comes to my mind either.
Perhaps it's one reason why there's been a lot of attention paid recently to black women as victims of this because they're getting it through heterosexual contact, mm-hmm. which seems to make them, get more media attention, that this is a high proportion. But I did notice in this packet from the Centers for Disease Control that it is still black men that get the disease much more often than black women.
That's true. And I was going to, as you were your earlier remarks, I was thinking the language that's changed. We used to talk about innocent victims. We've moved away from that as language because certainly no one wants to, or very few people are intentionally are trying to become infected with HIV. And so that tone, that morality, I think tells a lot about how we as a culture are thinking about this. And I think we also need to shift away from people being given HIV infection to think about what is our everybody's responsibility to protect oneself as well as one's partners. And so as we think about where the transmission patterns are happening, let's remember it's a two-way street, that people have responsibility to protect themselves as well as people who are HIV infected having responsibility to try not to transmit the disease.
This period of several years before it can manifest itself, AIDS or HIV, does make it a little trickier to know exactly how to target, doesn't it? I mean, other than obviously targeting to the youth, I mean, to, you know, high school, even junior high school students. But is there any kind of sense of, other than outside of the schools, how to target people and make them aware?
Right. In fact, there's a lot of, when we think about public health prevention strategies, there's a lot of work happening within community-based organizations, we call them CBOs, that are placed in communities and certainly have strong relationships with the community members for whom they work or where they serve. And so there are educational programs there. Some may be attracting young people to educational programs. Others are for men who are living with HIV, for example, or heterosexual women who may be at higher risk for HIV. So those kinds of public health approaches that are targeted to a particular community and are really about education are promising, especially those that are based on evidence and have been tested to be effective strategies.
So how do you get to some of those marginalized populations that you mentioned? How do you actually – I mean, they're not going to be reading, you know, the latest Journal of the American Medical Association or even necessarily going to a movie if you could get to them through a trailer like that. I mean, how do you get to that hardcore population that really has the highest incidence?
And that's a really challenging and ongoing question. And a whole range of strategies have been used. Some of it is – working with organizations that we might not normally think of as being connected to or people to be in a position of providing prevention messages. But I'm thinking about bar outreach as one example. Historically, there's been quite a bit of work that's been going on
in
bars.
You mean literally bars.
Bars, you're right, mm-hmm. For men who have sex with men. So if you identify specific venues, really, to have conversations, to provide condoms, to provide HIV testing, that can be one way to reach folks that might not be reached in other ways. Pride Fest would be another example of that, where it's a larger venue, but an opportunity to say, remember, this is an issue. Here's an opportunity to be tested. There's been some work with hairdressers, for example, because of the relationship or the conversations, really, that take place within.
What an interesting idea.
Yeah. There is outreach that happens. The needle exchange program would be another example of that, where there are vans, actually, and one-on-one conversations. So people become knowledgeable about others who can provide services. There's more work or some work happening in faith communities, organizations that are serving other communities, and youth shelters is an opportunity. More can be done. Women who are transitioning from being sex workers to having other options in their lives, again, there are programs that are providing support. And so a large part of what's happening now is trying to integrate HIV prevention messages into existing services that are going on. We're trying to make sure that within emergency rooms, the healthcare providers there are aware of this. It's on their radar that people could be tested or should be tested for HIV.
As long as you've mentioned people who work in the industry, do we have any kind of a sense of what the percentage of prostitutes in this country would be infected, are infected?
I don't have numbers for you, and I think it really varies within the social group, really, of sex workers. We know that there can be a norm in which protection is used that doesn't always work because one can be paid more if protection is not being used.
You only need one instance of not using to blow the system.
And the importance of being tested. So I'm sorry I don't have the numbers for you, but I'd say that it's certainly high-risk work. And it's also a good point in that one can know or want to use protection or say yes and no, but women don't always have the choice. That's certainly true for sex workers, but it can also be true in all kinds of relationships. But people who are having to trade sex for money or for drugs or for shelter or for food, and that's, you know, certainly the reality for many people who are at high risk, that's real, and they don't always have a whole lot of options. And I'd say when we look at young people who are at most at risk, those are factors that come into play there too. that many of the young people are certainly young men who have sex with men. They may have been pushed out of homes, their own homes. They may be living on the street. It's a tough, can be a tough position to be in. And so it's not always as easy. It's clearly not as easy as saying, here's the information. Here's what we know you need to do. What's the problem here? There are just too many layers to make it, to understand it in those simplistic terms.
More on HIV/AIDS prevention when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
We want to know what you think. Your comments are important to us, and our audience services team is ready to help. Get in touch with Wisconsin Public Radio anytime, day or night. Visit WPR.org and click on Listener Feedback.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Nara Cox, who's filling us in about some approaches to the prevention of HIV and AIDS. You mentioned that one really neat idea, at least I thought. I'm not sure what the theater managers would think about running, you know, trailers before films at movie theaters that would inform young people in particular about the risks of contracting HIV. And you said that was a European idea that's in practice. Are there some other ones that they're onto over there that we might think about?
Right. And actually, I should say it was a great honor. I was able to go with Advocates for Youth, which is a youth-serving organization based in Washington, D.C., go with them a number of years ago on a study tour to Europe. We visited France, Germany, and the Netherlands to learn more about adolescent sexuality and European approaches to that. But certainly HIV and AIDS prevention was a part of that. And one of the huge take-home messages was that they really seemed to focus, to rely on the science and the evidence for public policies as well as for services more than on the politics or the morality. And I think, you know, that's a huge distinction between how we approach these issues here in the States. So, yes, one of the ideas was the media campaign there, or media campaigns. They keep them fresh, but it's science that's guiding that. They're designed very intentionally. They're tracked every, I don't know how many weeks it was or however many months, but would survey folks to see what the changes were in terms of attitudes and knowledge. And then there'd be another series of billboards or trailers to keep conversations going.
Does Europe have a lower rate than the United States?
They do a much better job in terms of sexually transmitted infections with young people. And those were really the data we were looking at rather than HIV in particular. So collectively, I'd say, yes, they have a much, much more impressive rate. Young people are not less sexually active in Europe than they are in the United States, but the sexually transmitted infection rates are much lower. But another take-home really from Europe was that the way adolescent sexuality was addressed was within the context of relationships. And while we like to believe that's true here, it does seem that there are more short-term sexual relationships here than seem to be the case in Europe.
That's kind of ironic, isn't it? Here we have this more kind of moral envelope for the whole thing, and yet we have more of these casual sexual relationships.
Right. And I think part of it is they view it as a youth development approach, meaning they understand that sexuality is a part of who we all are and expect that young people are going to be in relationships and learn from relationships and at some point within the context of a relationship have a sexual intimacy or sexual component. But make sure that young people have the knowledge and the skills and the attitudes to manage all that. So if you view sexuality and sexual behavior as a normal and healthy development for young people, then it seemed to us in Europe you don't shy away from that. You just make sure that young people have what they need. They have information. They have access to services. They have skills to have conversations with their partners and with the partner decide when and what that sexual intimacy will look like.
So the non-judgmental approach.
Very much so.
What about the argument that would be made here by many, I think, that if you take a 14-year-old and you say, here are condoms, here's information, this is what you could do, that you might, in the case of a 14-year-old who is not sexually active, be sort of giving a green light, and here's how you do it, and this is how you can be safe. I mean, I think that's probably the biggest impediment that would get in the way of school programs is the sense that some parents would have that.
Or actually endorsing it.
You know, that you're promoting it.
That is actually the concern that many parents have, and the science behind that says that by providing young people with information and skills and knowledge, you are not hastening sexual activity, and there's quite a bit of research to support that. So based on the science here and looking at the examples we saw in Europe, I feel pretty confident that we can take a different tact and support our young people well. It did seem that in Europe, and this is based on street interviews we did with lots and lots of young people and their parents or adults, it seemed that there wasn't this rushing into the sexual intimacy part, but they wanted to feel confident that the relationship, the non-sexual relationship pieces were in place. And then with that solidly in place, eventually there would be the sexual intimacy. I think, too, in this country, when the concern about sexuality education or HIV prevention education in schools, what we have done is actually made it very narrow, that it has become very specific in terms of what we're trying to prevent, particular behaviors. And while that's important, another approach is to broaden sexuality education so that it isn't just STD prevention or
like
pregnancy
prevention.
Absolutely.
Involvement.
And having said that, though, I think there's also the concern if we did that only halfway, then we might also be shortchanging the very specific information that kids need so that we do prevent pregnancies and prevent sexually transmitted infections.
It doesn't sound like they're at all mutually exclusive. No reason that you couldn't start with the, as they seem to be doing in Europe, this notion of how to enter into a relationship and then get to the sexual specifics of it after the prerequisite is satisfied.
Right. And I think, we would need to begin with young people, very young people. You know, how do you communicate? What is a good friendship when you're young? How does that evolve as you become an adolescent? So it's making a larger commitment to sexuality education, very broadly defined, and we're not quite there yet.
What about the stigma attached to HIV/AIDS in Europe compared to in this country?
Again, I'd say that it's a more open and honest approach, that there is not the stigma that we are seeing here. I should also say, though, that's one important piece. There's more openness in terms of gay and lesbian relationships or gay and lesbian and bisexual relationships. So that's more out in the open. What I was going to say is I think we need to remember that there is perhaps less diversity within the three European countries I mentioned, France, Netherlands, and then there is here. And so that's a challenge that I think we're learning from here and figuring some things out that we can teach Europe. It's not just us being the students of what's going on in Europe. So, yes, I think there's less stigma at this point in Europe. We can learn from that, and we need to realize that we've got more diversity here. And as we figure that out, we can probably teach Europe a thing or two as well.
And if you had unlimited power and unlimited dollars, what sort of programs would you like to see implemented here?
I would really do a lot more with parent education. I think families are so critical that if we could build healthier families and parents who felt confident and comfortable talking with their children about sexuality from the very, very early stages, that would provide a good foundation. And then I would do more in terms of school-based education.
We keep coming back to that, don't we? The importance, I mean, it's obvious, but it keeps coming back, the importance of the family in the educational context. And, of course, that's one thing that is, in a way, in such a shambles in this country. I don't know about Europe, but stable families are really getting harder to find.
They are. And I think we can define families in different ways. But I think if we think of families as caring and loving relationships with the folks who are living there, those messages about the importance of taking care of oneself and responsibility for oneself and responsibility for partners, those are universal, or could be universal in terms of messages, regardless of what family looks like, what the family structure looks like.
What would you do to increase the amount of testing that's done, since we have so many people that
sure.
are...
Sure. That needs to happen as well.
And how would you do that in a way that wasn't big brother-like?
I think, we can't hit people over the head with this and say that you have to, but by normalizing it, that it's a medical condition, it's something we can prevent to the extent that we have blood pressure checked, height and weight, unfortunately, checked. We can normalize HIV testing as well. Cholesterol testing that doesn't have a stigma to it, it's done if you are fortunate enough to have regular health care, it's done routinely. And so I don't think that it's a huge leap to say we could move ourselves into the direction of HIV testing in the same way.
Doing it in the schools, you mean, for example, as part of a battery of tests, or how would you do it?
That may be stretching quite thin the poor school nurse who's already overwhelmed.
Well, I mean, we assume it would have to be some kind of unit that would come in, you know, on a rotating basis from school to school. But even so, speaking of stretching things thin, we get back a little bit into that Big Brother issue again, don't we? Too much government involvement in schools or personal lives.
Well, I think I guess I tend to think of it more as a menu of options and providing the resources for people to not only to have those options available, but the resources for people to take advantage of them. So to me, that doesn't come across so much as a Big Brother, but here are some things that you can do to protect your health, not only the knowledge and options about it, but accessing services. And that was actually one of the other messages from Europe, is that young people felt comfortable accessing services, birth control services or family planning kinds of services or health checkups. And clinics would make sure that they were structured in a way that was comfortable for young people. So I think, I'm not sure it has to happen in the schools here, but perhaps in the schools, making young people aware that there are services available for them that are affordable, that are easy to get to, and that are just part of what one does to take care of oneself.
But, I mean, the catch is that if somebody is 14, 15, 16 years old and has contracted HIV, the sooner everybody knows it, the better.
The sooner that young person knows it and can get connected to care,
right,
the better. I think we still need to be very careful to maintain confidentiality. And there's no reason for everybody in the school to know if a young person has
right.
HIV infection.
Right. But in terms of, yes, the student and the healthcare provider.
To work in partnership to keep that kid as healthy as possible for many, many, many years.
And are there good websites and hotlines for people who want more information about where to find a testing site or, you know,
right. And I would encourage people to Google Wisconsin HIV and AIDS, and they'll go to the State AIDS Program homepage, which then can link them to free testing in various regions around the state, because there are a lot of options for people to be tested, if not at their own healthcare provider.
Our guest has been Nara Cox, professor in the Continuing Studies Division. Thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.